I'm not even sure how long I should talk for now. We've lost control of all time. I mean, in my Formula One days, this would never have been permitted, Ben and Sean. And it's just been great, in any case, to be invited to such a great symposium to watch. Like a very Australian experience of watching the two masters of America and England battle it out for dominion over the hearts and minds of Australians. It's also a little distressing too to go on as the third person. When I was speaking to James Jiang about this, as he said, knowing my love of the Rose sisters, you'll be the broken middle. So here's the broken and inverted middle for you. I also have a number of apologies, which I'll keep apologising throughout this paper for a number of reasons. Let me get started and then get back to the apologies shortly. So the problem of exemplarity is at the heart of modern aesthetics, precisely because, to use the Kantian terminology, art can be neither reducible to science nor morality, neither understanding nor reason. It can be neither a determining nor normative judgment if it is to have a room of its own. As Hegel notes in his Aesthetics regarding this exemplarily modern dilemma or drama of the example, art explores, quote, the most subjective, non-conceptual and ephemeral phenomena, end of quote, yet does this in language the medium of objective conceptual knowledge. For this philosophical tradition, then, perception must be able to change thinking, cognition, not through the former's matter nor experience of matter or substance, but through form, that is, through examples. And yes, it can't contravene either the laws of nature or of morality at the same time. As a result, the affect proper to form, from Kant onwards, is indifference, that is, a pleasure irreducible to any particular feeling as a free play of the faculties. Otherwise, if aesthetics did end up being tied to any particular feeling, we would be involved in something other than aesthetics. Moreover, the form to which this affect is correlated is forms extremely complex assemblage. It's not reducible and never been reducible to a simple gestalt. And simultaneously, as it's an incredibly complex organisation, it must also be something inexistent. It cannot exist. And there's a reason. Form has an ontological status that is precisely disinterested, i.e. it has no particular substance, matter, anything like that to which an interest could attach. As such, it doesn't exist. And so form is something that's simultaneously absolutely patent and, in fact, complex and absolutely inexistent at the same time. So hence the problems I might suggest of exemplarity that have been bequeathed to us and about which we're arguing. On the one hand, form must be a technical assembly. It can be technically assemblage, incredibly complex, yet it doesn't exist. And therefore, when you try and point to it and say, that is a form, everyone immediately, as we've seen throughout the last few days, everyone starts to squeal. No! So, if it would exist, it would fall under physical interest. For example, this historical poetic snacks taste great, or moral interest, it's my duty not to lie to these murderers. And this has a number of immediate consequences. Firstly, the irreducible doubleness of aesthetics and its modern acceptation, at once science of perception per se, and of the ground of judgments of taste beyond any particular cognition or emotion. Secondly, the irreducible and accompanying problematic of ideology, which suggests unconscious or even conscious motivations, covert motivations, determining decisions regarding beauty. And of course, that gives rise to cadres of technicians who consciously attempt to manipulate the intuitions of others. And then thirdly, and very famously in Kant, the attempt to construct an appropriate category of the singular universal, the famous as-if structure of a reflective judgment. Now, this has two moments, I guess, that are going to be relevant to my discussion. Every example is to raise the question of individuation in some ways. I want to give examples given by Bernard Smith, who in his very famous and influential European vision in the South Pacific, notes that the Academy artists and nautical and scientific draftsmen working together on the 18th century British voyages of exploration. Sometimes these Academy artists and the scientific draftsmen, all on the boats together, would work on similar tasks and under officers, moreover, trained according to Royal Navy and Royal Society principles of empirical observation. So this had the double effect, according to Smith, of first making the renderings of the artists less neoclassical than might be expected under pressure of the anomalies they were asked to depict, and those anomalies are anthropological, botanical, and so forth. And secondly, simultaneously, of forcing someone like Joseph Banks, I believe we're in Bankstown at the moment, just by the way, not irrelevantly, to encourage the artists to also depict exotic travel scenes with the aims of exciting audiences back home. So you then have the bizarre experience of the neoclassical artists becoming much more empirical and empiricist under the pressure of the anomalies and also of the pressure from above, and at the same time then being asked to re-neoclassicize the scenes by putting in various reclining Tahitian women and so forth, chatting in postures of neoclassicism. So all the paradoxes of representation in this case and exemplarity are here foregrounded. The anomalies that are astray in vegetation, for example, become simultaneously spurs to new levels of scientific precision and to global taxonomic transformation. But also in inducing the breaking of received form under pressure of perception, these things also become, to speak as Immanuel Kant does of parrots, free beauties of nature, as they also become fodder for technicians of kitsch. Further, they become the objects for primitive accumulation and colonial appropriation. So that's one of the first implications I want to just mark. The second one is to do with, I guess, what Lacour, Labat and Nancy call the romantic absolute. If something like a novelty, for instance, is covertly projected by Kant as a vital element of form creation in the presentation of new forms for the delectation of an aesthetic audience, then by a kind of an inexorable logic, we end up with the problem that if you can say that this or that thing is definitely art, then it definitely isn't. And so we end up with the paradoxes of the undecidable and the indiscernible, which bear upon aesthetic objects as such, and an irresolvable kind of paradoxical, constant shifting. And so, to start with, I've given Astrid Lorange said to me, "Oh yes." As soon as this conference came up, she started searching her computer for example. I did the same thing. There's some of the quotes I've pulled up for you on example, all of which I think have a part of this. But again, I just on the background of this Kantian triplet of science, ethics, and aesthetics recurs at once. Real exemplar and exemplarily a kind of unknowing registration of colonial adventures and a matrix of romantic avant-gardism at the same time. So these two things are simultaneously at play, intricated and disturbing for everyone. But the person I want to speak about today, unfortunately this is one of the first of my apologies, is that I've become so obsessed with him recently that this paper is now just insanely detailed in some parts, which will be of probably no interest to anyone but me, but I have written those out, and then a whole load of kind of weird background information and strange thoughts that have occurred to me, which have been inserted into my paper in a random fashion. So if I start to sort of myself, dissolve under pressure of this doubleness, you'll understand. I'm the broken middle. Now, Baron Field, extremely, extremely interesting fellow. He's well known to historians of Australian literature, but almost not at all to anybody else. Even for Australians, his legacy is obscure and ambiguous at best. And today I only want to point to some, exemplary aspects of his work, which I believe have some quite surprising implications for the history of poetry in Australia. I'm going to try and strike a balance between basic information and justified interpretation, insofar as that's possible. I'll speak directly to some elements of Field's poetry, as well as to the commonly held belief in Australian literary history that that, for example, Australia went directly from neoclassicism to Victorianism without passing through an intervening period of Romanticism, or alternatively, were for the first divided between vernacular pop ballads and sophisticated literary effusions, or alternatively, that in fact Romanticism started much earlier in Australia than it did anywhere else, precisely because of its first-rate, second-rate nature. It's the kind of derivative, the priority of aggressive derivativeness in Australian literary history. So I'm going to want to speak to all of these kind of, I guess, oppositions or histories as well. And the paradox of form that I just briefly mentioned in the Kantian legacy means that form is at once situated in time and place, yes, as I said before, too, as inexistent, cannot simply be subject to time, although in neither case is it simply historical either. Yet it's also simultaneously historical, precisely as Field himself would say, in that, as hopefully we'll see, for Field, only history can open you up to nature. You can only have an unmediated apprehension of nature if you already have a history that separated you from that nature. It's kind of a strange dialectical subroutine in Field's work. And yet his own poems, and I'm going to use poems in scare quotes and say a bit more about them, because they're not really great poems, as you'll see if you don't already know them. And it looks to me now that they're quite deliberately shitty poems. Like he's quite deliberately writing bad poetry. And I'm going to give you some very, very specific reasons why I think this so. However, his own poems then take their professed lack of history as a block to the nature which they're precisely blocking. Access of Field himself to the very nature that he seems to be describing in such a way as to give the nature that he's in fact blocking himself from a power to derange every existing form or the inheritances of form that he's brought with him from England. So that form breaks, and then only the broken or the medley form of, I guess, apoems is one word I could use, not all apoems, since isn't that what you titled this then? Apoems? Not all apoems are not poems or apoems in the same way. Should also underline that. And what you end up is with a kind of concatenation in his work of a retrospective tradition of broken forms. That is, he codes it as satire, that is, of moments in which the continuities of form and temporality are simultaneously crossed and ruptured. Moreover, for Field, he's writing at precisely the time, so to speak, that recognisably modern forms of history are emerging. If you know, I'm not sure whether I agree with it or whether you do, but Stephen Bann's work about the birth of history, it precisely begins in the late 18th, early 19th century in the form that we'd recognise as kind of the causal intrication of both social and natural forces, environmental and civilizational, all working their way out in a kind of a web that is simultaneously sublations of history and of necessity and contingency. So bizarrely then, at the beginning of history, Field finds that his own lack of history requires a counter-history to show how his poetry can't be poetry. It must fail to establish itself as poetry in order to precisely show something that it otherwise would be unable to show. Now, the thing that he's famous for, I guess, insofar as you can be famous in the field of Australian poetry, is that his claim to fame is that he published the first book of poetry in this country in 1819. It's a collection you can see there. This is from the first edition. You can see 1819. This copy is in the collection of the Mitchell Library here in Sydney. One of the fun facts that I found is slightly anecdotal and irrelevant, that Mitchell, who of course his entire fortune was founded on coal mines in the Hunter Valley, like a rapacious colonial appropriator, as you'd expect, and of course he dedicated that money to acquiring books. The last book that he finally received on the day he died was in fact this. So it was a kind of death warrant. He'd been hunting it for a long time. He receives the book and promptly drops dead. So Goodbye, Mr. Mitchell. Now, this book is called, as you can see, collection. It's entitled First Fruits of Australian Poetry. I'd like you to note every single word in that title, which is actually a much more bizarre title, as I'm going to try and argue, than one might initially think. It's comprised of only two poems, Botany Bay Flowers, the other one's The Kangaroo. He then republishes this book with four further poems in 1823, and then, finally, as an appendix to a collection of colonial documents called Geographical Memoirs on New South Wales. It has an extremely extended 19th century title, which he publishes in 1925 when he's back in London with John Murray. So as a poet, he publishes only two books of poetry in his lifetime, First Fruits, in these three strange editions, 1819, 1823, and 1825, and then Spanish Sketches in 1841. And a scattered handful of individual poems in British and Australian magazines too. It's very, it's important to say both books were self-published by Field and using the official governmental printers. He's the judge of the colony of New South Wales from about 1816 to 1824. He's the highest ranking judicial officer in the colony. He's then, due to a bad report about him, he's basically repatriated and punished with a £400 a year annuity, and then ends up after a bit of argy-bargy in Gibraltar, where he's chief magistrate. And in fact, his second book, Spanish Sketches, is published then. Both of these books are self-published, but they're using the official governmental printer. And both bear on the declaration on the title page, as you can see there, printed for private distribution. So he's using the government printer, the only printer in the colony at that stage, to expressly say this is for private means. So he's, we'll talk a little bit about this as we go. In fact, Field, when you start unfortunately looking into him, he's influential in a range of important matters in the colony at a time when the vicissitudes of individuals could prove to have highly significant consequences. So I've mentioned he's a barrister and a colonial judge. As John McLaren writes, Field's record as a judge could best be described as mercurial, a reflection of his conservative belief system, a commitment to the culture of English law, and an opportunistic streak in his character. This feature comes up. And McLaren concludes, Field's counsel was not invariably sound or in keeping with the colonial officer's understanding of the legal proprieties. So very important. He's a dodgy judge, and I think New South Wales has continued to experience the joy of Field since then. Moreover, the founder, the Bank of New South Wales, is, strangely enough, is founded in 1817. Percival Searle in the Dictionary of Australian Biography and Sage Curry seem to suggest that Field was the founder of that bank. I think this is false. I do have to apologise. I really am at the beginning of my research. I don't think he was the founder of this bank. This bank still exists. It's now called Westpac for Australians, if you're interested. But even though I don't believe it was there, I think Darcy Wentworth was much more important in the founding of this bank in 1817. Sorry, I'm giving you dates not just for, I guess that's historical reasons, historical poetical reasons. He nonetheless was involved with this bank, which of course then, when the colonists stopped using rum as the, yes, that was a little earlier, obviously. Is it the only place in the world where rum has been used as the currency? Is this true? Does anyone know? This is until 1808. Anyway, and then we're poor old Bligh. Anyway, it means that the bank can start issuing money. And it looks like, in fact, one of the reasons Field is considered as, he was influential in the important in the founding of the bank, is because I think he'd falsely advised Macquarie, Lachlan Macquarie was the governor at the time. He'd advised Macquarie falsely that Macquarie had the power to, in fact, start a bank without the say-so so of Parliament. And just keep that in mind, because it actually has some strange implications just a few years later for this book of poetry. He's also very important as, as an amateur scientist and a sponsor of early colonial adventuring in the colony of New South Wales and in its environs. A recent article in the botanical journal Telepierre, titled "Justice for Justice Baron Field," reminds us that two genera and one species have been named in his honour. And there's in fact a new combination recently, Senna Baron Fieldi, which is a technical term for an Australian plant. He's sort of everywhere in a dirty way. As a social figure, he's, you would expect he's a very important social figure in the colony at the time, one of the most authoritative and powerful figures. He's a direct descendant in the male line from Oliver Cromwell, of which he's very, very proud. He used it in social circumstances. He would tell everyone. And it actually comes back to bite him when John MacArthur at one stage basically tries to challenge him to a duel, saying, "You are a guy who claims you're a direct descendant of Oliver Cromwell. In fact, why are you always sucking up to the powerful instead of helping the little guys?" If you know anything about John MacArthur, I don't think you could say he was a little guy, but there you go. He founds the Philosophical Society in quite short-lived in Australia. Some of the minutes of that society are still extant. He also is involved in a number of other societies in Australia, including the Society for the Improvement of Aborigines, which involves, of course, a kind of Christianizing missionary aspect to it. And he also had plans to establish several other institutions, including, and I'll underline this one, a natural history museum. But before he'd even got to the colony, he was known, not a particularly grandiose figure, but he was a literary critic. He was the theatre critic for the Times of London. And he hung out with people like, who you might have heard of, like William Wordsworth and Coleridge and Charles Lamb and Leigh Hunt. So he was a quite good friend. He was very good friends of Hunt and Lamb. And he, in fact, wrote a Memoirs of Wordsworth, never published in his lifetime. I might have time to speak a little bit about that. They were scotched. The memoirs were scotched by Wordsworth himself, who writes a very strong letter to Field saying, "Don't ever publish this." Even though, thank you for your fanboy attitude towards me, but it's really not very welcome. In fact, as Wordsworth writes to him, "After maturely considering the subject, I must regret I am decidedly against the publication of your critical memoir." I think that was in 1840, so I think it's just before Field dies in 1846. And then in his dotage, in addition to this, he's responsible for doing some editing of Elizabeth, early modern drama, Thomas Hayward, Thomas Legg, and some other people as well, for the Shakespeare Society. And you can also find those. They were published in the 1840s. He's quite a good editor, and I want to come back to his editorial skills, because they're crucial in understanding how he reads other people, such that you can see the ways in which he's reading inscribed within the sorts of poems, or like the way in which he assembles his poems. But as I guess I'm implying, nobody has really known what to make of Field. There we go. There's a noisy, obtrusive, jargonic judge, Benjamin Disraeli. Bumped into him in 1830, and that's what Disraeli had to say. And you can see there just a short timeline. One of the things he has done, and it's very difficult to find, and I haven't been down there, but I really need to get there, is he actually, as you can see, in 1822, he puts up a memorial to Banks and Cook at the alleged landing of the in New South Wales originally. No one's known what to make of him. As you've heard, he seems to be a kind of type of Anglican Tory jurist. He's bumptious or braggadocious, as a Donald Trump would say his poems are usually have been generally dismissed as poor, clumsy. And in fact, when I was speaking to Ivor Indyk the other day, I'm going to see if I can find this photo. I'd got into he quoted a barren field indeed, which is one of the squibs written about a barren field. If you give me a second, I was in the Mitchell on Monday just trying to take photographs of their of some of their archives on field, and one of the anonymous squibs, which is the one that Ivor quoted back to me. We don't know who it is. "Thy poems, barren field, I've read, and thus adjudge their meed. So poor a crop proclaims thy head, a barren field indeed." So these are some of the kind of contemporaneous responses to the poor barren. Although a lamb, one of his friends and a correspondent with Field, while Field was still in Australia, did review the poems for the Examiner, in which he declared in inauspicious, unliterary thief land that the author of these lines might have been sent there as a plagiarist. And in fact, plagiarism is very important to Field, as we'll see. Now, but this is part of the problem with this book, not very well known, and even though it's the first book of poems published in Australia, Field's a very ambivalent figure, and he's still not always invariably included in anthologies of Australian poetry. Jamie Grant doesn't include any in his Australian 100 Australian Poems You Should Read. Page and Lehman think he's out of the main game of OzPo. He's only sporadically, in Bertram Stevens, the first major anthology of Australian verse from 1906, mentions Barren Field in passing, but doesn't anthologise him. And Stevens, in fact, writes, "One wishes for his sake that the verses were more worthy." And then goes on immediately to announce that the first poem of any of importance by an Australian is William Charles Wentworth's WCW, bizarrely, Australasia. And Vivian Stevens in the recent Cambridge Companion notes, "Field's book is still valued for its depiction of the colonial scene and its local flora and fauna, and denominates Field's poem, The Kangaroo, an exuberant oddity." But it's only a paragraph dedicated. Nonetheless, someone like David Higgins writes, "It's appropriate to see First Fruits as a foundational Australian text precisely because of its troubled transnationalism," end of quote. As I've been trying to indicate, it's only in and for Australia that Field has this function. Otherwise, he's near vanished from the literary, scientific and political record, despite his backgrounds. And in fact, there's something emblematically Australian, I should say, about this abiding marginality. However, despite this marginal and unsettled appreciation of Field's, A.D. Cousins has written a fabulous essay about Field, which is titled "Barren Field and the Translation of Romanticism to Colonial Australia," and notes that the First Fruit poems form a curious and important instance of a motif which can be seen in many different attempts at national identity formation, a motif useful in the establishing and maintaining of colonies. Translatio imperii est judi. To be more specific, I shall argue that in his First Fruits, Barren Field ponders a negation of translatio studi, the impossibility of translating what is, in effect, a Wordsworthian vision of nature to the Antipodean New World, and therefore of imposing comprehensively on that New World an English cultural identity. Now, one of the... here we go. I've taken some of these photos myself, unfortunately. The one on the right here is the inscription, as you can see, to Samuel Taylor Coleridge Esquire, with the author's best respects. This is in the National Library of Australia. I still have to find out how they acquired Coleridge's version of this, but you can see for private distribution, Field was like, "Hey, Sam, take this." Now... although there really won't be the time to go into this today, the editings and re-editings, extremely careful that Field did for the three versions of this First Fruits, or three editions, or rather two editions plus inclusion in the appendix of Geographical Memoirs. They're a whole load of things go on between the editions, which is extremely interesting. And what I'd like to just draw your attention to in particular is Field's incessant also revisions of his own paratextual apparatus and, I guess, literary citations. And particularly if you pay attention to his epigraphs and notes, which if indeed receiving some critical attention have never really fully been interpreted by his critics. Certainly from the very beginning, commentators and readers have recognised what Jaya Savage recently asserted in his essay in Australian Poetry, in Poetry of April this year. He says, to 21st century eyes, Field's thefts betray a poetics of appropriation and citation that wouldn't look entirely out of place in a Kenneth Goldsmith class. More, as I said before, Charles Lamb is the first person to expressly say this in print. For his part, Higgins reads Field's poems as poems of effacement of the Indigenous people. Paul Carter reads Field as offering a critique of associationism. I think he's quite wrong, but we can come back to this. Burns insists on returning Field to his context. I gave that quote before. Bernard Smith is a very good reader of Field, and he wants to place Field in the episteme of Enlightenment self-transformation through colonial encounter. And Cousins, as I cited before, wants to note the attempt at translatio studii, the priority of Wordsworth as a prime precursor, the pressure of the singularity of the site, the inversions and displacements of scientific and aesthetic taxonomy, and the centrality of illusion in Field. One of the things that Cousins does mention, which I do think is extremely important, is that Cousins is probably the only person I've managed to find so far who reads some of the epigraphs and also some of the allusions of Fields to point towards a satirical history or a satirical tradition in which the relationship between romance and satire, that translation is at stake. In fact, the references to some of the Elizabethans that Cousins notes in Field's poetry, and we'll come to this more in a minute, if you read the original context, as Cousins tries to reconstruct it, you can see that these epigraphs really are trying to denote this kind of counter-tradition of satire as a kind of response to the perceived impossibility of the romance genre. And of course, that has a bearing on Australia. So paying attention to Field's particular operations of, quotation, citation, paraphrase, and so forth, shows us something not only about the local construction of these poems, but of their relation to site and their putative audiences. In fact, allusion is key to Field's work, whether explicit or implicit, whether marked by name or image or meter or tone or by some other indication. As Geoffrey Little, who Sean Pryor told me in the car this morning, tried to kill him by feeding him prawns a couple of decades ago in the Hawkesbury. And Geoffrey Little is possibly the scholar who's done the most work on Field. Some very, very excellent annotations, and particularly with respect to Field's relationship to Wordsworth, where the pedantry of someone like Fields can't be overemphasised. He was constantly sending letters to Wordsworth saying, in line 3 of book 4 of the Prelude, you have used this adjective. It is completely inappropriate according to the doctrines outlined in your preface to the Lyrical Ballads, plus your work otherwhere. And in fact, he constantly bombarded Wordsworth with these sorts of criticism. Yeah, he was a stalker tweeter. The thing was, is that, like, unlike trolling today or stalker tweets, is that, like, Wordsworth clearly took Field extremely seriously, despite, as I said before, the scotching of the memoirs. And in fact, Wordsworth makes a large number of corrections in his re-editions of his poetry along the lines that Field suggests. And if you're interested in these, have a look at Geoffrey Little's. There's two very good articles on this, plus his introduction to Geoffrey Little's re-edition of them and publication of the memoirs of Wordsworth. And I have to say the level of intensity of Field's reading, it's extremely pedantic. It may not be precisely a literary, but it is very, very legalistic. And I should come to it at some point, depending on how the crappy organisation of my talk is going. I should come to it at some point. Field is also the author of a textbook on Blackstone's Laws of England, which is a bestseller. It's gone into many, many, many editions, and in fact, it's deliberately aimed at students. And in fact, this analysis, as Field calls it, of Blackstone. It's funny in that I think it's published in 1811 to start with. Field is very, very clearly concerned about priority because, as he says in the introduction to his analysis of Blackstone, he says, isn't it funny that how influential Blackstone is and it's yet had no analysis given? This is the first analysis that has yet been offered. And so Field's very, very concerned with the identification of firstness or priority in his legal work and his poetry. So to reiterate, as Little has shown, we can see from Field's reading practices, evidenced in his scholarly notes, travelogues and judgments, he's a source hunter in others' works, and he deploys sources very carefully in his own. And his skills in this regard are at the very least creditable. As Little points out, Field was probably the first to assert in print that Coleridge had adapted The Ancient Mariner from Shel Vock's Voyages, and he seemed to know this way before, like decades before Hazlitt or in fact any of the other commentators, and various other things in his editions of citations of Elizabethan and Jacobean early modern English texts. Now, this is the first poem in the second edition of the 1823 Botany Bay Flowers. If source hunting perhaps means one thing for literary scholars, another thing or two for critics and reviewers, other things yet for poets, and yet other things for a personage such as Field, who claims that when writing in Australia, there is yet no sources in the country in which and of which he is writing as not a poet. He expressly says in his poetry he's not a poet. He also introduces so a large number of strange sources and also several key allusions are certainly inserted as a result of correspondence with friends such as Lamb, for whom they're intended to function, I think, as a form of familiar homosocial literary exchange, but whose legibility to others could only be tenuous at best. There's some secret messages are clearly being passed between for public, private, secret messages are being passed by Field to Lamb through the mediation of this text. And also, as Higgins points out, Field's principal method in trying to make the strange sights and feelings of the voyage to New South Wales understandable to his readers is to provide literary quotations. What I just want to want to point to a number of things. This is in the second edition. The first edition of sorry, I need to even know who's responsible for this like outrage. All right, I'm just going to start to reassemble in an odd way. If you look at the first government printer in 1819 is George Howe. He's the second person. The printing press was brought over by Phillips on the First Fleet, arrived in 1788. No one could use it till at least 1796, when the first printer, of course a convict, was basically keel hauled to produce it. When Howe turns up, he was actually born in the West Indies. I'm not quite sure of exactly where Howe was born. He becomes the government printer for a long, long time until his death in 1821. But there's certainly he ended up in Australia on the basis of some shoplifting. But then he became the official government printer. The first book, of course, ever published in this country and in this colony is Governmental Records. So I think it's from 1803, and it's about that time that, in fact, Howe also starts to produce the New South Wales Gazette. very, very important, I guess, newspaper in this country, in the first one. So how is the printer? He's the government printer, as I said. I haven't as yet been able to ascertain whether it's clearly a misuse of governmental resources on Field's part to get his book printed by Howe. I'm not even sure if any money changed hands. I'm sure something did, but I'm not quite sure how that transaction or negotiation took place. Now, by 1823, Howe was dead and the publication had been taken over by his son, Richard Howe, who in fact is responsible for this, the 1823 version. In the 1821 version, in the 1819 version, There's far fewer, as you can see, the epigraphs there. We had Lucretius, we now have Chaucer, we have Shakespeare, we have George Withers. And not only that, if you don't know the Latin to the Lucretius, which in fact is an extract from a book one of De Rerum Natura, there at the bottom there's a loose translation which has been given as a note by Mark Akenside. And so you can see that the orientation, there's a massive expansion of this paratextual apparatus between the first and the second editions, and in quite a singular way, which I don't think I've got that much time left, so I'm going to have to go very, very fast. Now, the two poems of the first edition are Botany Bay Flowers and The Kangaroo. You can see the flora and fauna of the colony. And oriented by this incredible wealth of epigraphy. By the way, George Wither is kind of a in the circle around Drayton. He's briefly imprisoned for libel under James I, and then he fought on the parliamentary side in the Civil War. He was captured by the Royalists. He was going to be executed, but then Sir John Denham, who was presiding at the time, said, "No, we've got to save this man's life, because as long as he's alive, I can't be the worst poet in England." This is George Wither, who of course is quoted there from his poem Fair Virtue. It's also important that someone like Lamb had been writing is part of the romantic revivification and of Wither, and so even to use the Wither quote is for Field sending a message to Lamb saying I'm reading your articles in the Examiner here. So there's a number of other things about it, but just to emphasise that. Now this first poem, Botany Bay Flowers, you can see that these are my photos. They're not very good. I'm sorry. People, libraries seem to hate it when you break the spine of ancient books, but God damn them. God of this planet, for that name best fits the purblind view which men of this dim spot can take of thee, the God of suns and spheres. What desert forests and what barren plains. And you can see he will pun on his name continuously. Barren Field, he knows what it means. He's going to just crank up the puns on his name throughout his poetry, both in this first poem and in The Kangaroo, which is the follow-up poem in 1819 and is indeed the second poem in the 1823 edition. It goes on and on, and you can see a kind of romantic situation in some ways. There's allusions to Wordsworth, we murder to dissect and so forth, but very much so this. What desert forests and what barren plains lie unexplored by European eye in what our fathers called the Great South Land. Even in those tracts which we have visited, though thousands of thy vegetative works have by the hand of science, as 'tis called, been murdered and dissected, pressed and dried till all their blood and beauty are extinct, and named in barbarous Latin men's surnames with terminations of the Roman tongue, yet tens of thousands have escaped the search, the decimation, the alive impaling, nicknaming of God's creatures, scaped it all, still fewer, perhaps none of all these flowers have been by poets sung. Poets are few, and botanists are many, and good cheap. When first I landed on Australia's shore, I neither botanist nor poet truly, but less a seeker after facts than truth, a flower gladdened me above the rest. And he goes on and on. And it turns out he falls in love with a flower. It's mainly in a quite constrained iambic pentameter. And then he falls in love with another flower. In fact, here are the two flowers. The first flower he falls in love with, he says, is the one on the left. And then he has adultery. He commits adultery by falling in love with the second flower, at which point the meter, the illusions go totally haywire. The meter changes. He starts to cut and paste large chunks from Shakespeare, particularly Midsummer Night's Dream, Romeo and Juliet, The Tempest, and so on and so on. And then there's this crazy fantasia before, right at the end, he returns to the iambic pentameter with which he began, after having normalized himself after this crazy like division of a kind of like botanical situation. Do I want this? No, I don't have time. I'm just going to we can come and talk about that a little later. But the second poem, the kangaroo, is Michael Farrell himself has written. And how many papers has Michael? How many have you written on the kangaroo now?
Three
or so. So Michael's one of the few enthusiasts of this poem in like Australian literary history. And as he puts it in an unpublished paper, Field's poem is by turns comic, pompous, contemptuous, and contradictory. Possibly. Now, the kangaroo, one of the things I like about Michael in his presence and so forth, but one of the things that Michael does is concentrate in, when he reads the kangaroo, on the word itself, and then the fate of the name kangaroo in a whole series of very, very disparate poems across time. I want to concentrate here on something slightly different, but just to say that the kangaroo obviously seized the imagination, as you know, of people as soon as they were first allegedly described in English by Cook and Banks. And the first attested use of the word comes from Cook's 1770 journal, in which he states, "The animals which I have before mentioned, called by the natives kangaroo or kangaroo, while Banks's journal from the same experience at Endeavour River, Queensland, spells it kangaroo. John Hunter in 1793 spells it as we do now. The same year, Watkin Tench spells it kangaroo, K-A-N-G-U-R-O-O, adds that the word was itself introduced to the natives by the Europeans themselves. It's obviously a very, very negotiated word. It's founded on a mishearing and a misattribution, and all of the speculation regarding its meaning has not yet fully... So I just put this in there because I thought it was hilarious. This is a Southey poem from 1794 called Eleanor. Alone, you know, and for the music of the bleating flocks, alone is heard the kangaroo's sad note. And I know as fellow Australians, you also love to hear the kangaroo's sad note at evening. And there's a lovely, I think, 1780s image of a kangaroo feeding its young in the pouch from... Anyway, but this is some of the kangaroo. Kangaroo, kangaroo, thou spirit of Australia that redeems from utter failure, from perfect desolation, and warrants the creation of this fifth part of the earth, which would seem an afterbirth, not conceived in the beginning, for God blessed his work at first and saw that it was good, but emerged at the first sinning when the ground was therefore cursed, and hence this barren wood. Right? And you can see he goes on and on. I'm going to have to cut this short. I'm just going to very quickly point to a number of things. The name kangaroo drives the meter into radical anomaly. How are you going to scan this? I think this is a question. How are we going to scan this poem? Kangaroo, kangaroo, or kangaroo, kangaroo? Are we bidactylic or diacritic? But I don't know. Dicritic? Bicritic? I'm not sure. There's this the problem of it's slightly idiotic, but if you look at the way that the meter transforms itself with that beginning kangaroo, kangaroo, very, very difficult, and then the whole meter goes into kind of free fall. It's constantly shifting. The other thing that that I want to mention now, I'm sorry I can't go into all of the crazy archival stuff that I've been like, doing, is that to rhyme Australia with failure, this might be the first instance, but he also, in the first poem, Botany Bay Flowers, he's rhymed it with regalia as well. Regalia. Australia, regalia. But one of the things that's really, I really need to underline here is that, first of all, no one is calling Australia Australia at the time that Baron Fields is calling it Australia. Until 1814, when Matthew Flinders finally gets to publish after a number of famous misadventures, his account of his journey to Terra Australis, Macquarie from about 1815, and this is of course first written in 1819 or first published in 1819, starts to say, look, let's stop calling it just the colony of New South Wales, or as it's more often referred to, New Holland. Macquarie starts to have a bee in his bonnet, so to speak, about maybe renaming the whole of Australia Australia. So this is an early instance of the Australia as a name for the country as a whole. Not New Holland, which is much more popular, not Terra Australis, which is the educated gentleman's name, not just the colony of New South Wales. Australia is a new name in this situation. And like Baron Field is hammering it, like all the way. Now, sorry, I'm just going to basically skip to the end of and if you give me like a number of minutes, just a few more minutes to just sort of conclude a little telegraphically and in a very truncated form. When I've been going through all of these poems, trying to trace the allusions, and I've found a number of allusions. For example, can I say this? No one else has at least published, particularly with respect to someone like Jonathan Swift's A Tale of a Tub, about which there would be a lot to say in this context. But one of the things that has been very, very clear from rereading these poems with an eye to reading the suppressed or sometimes overt citations is that the history of satire from Bishop Hall in the 1590s, Joseph Hall, very interesting, who wrote a satire called Mundus Alter et Idem about the great Sutherland, Terra Australis, and in fact in the Tale of a Tub by Swift, there's also many, many hilarious references to Terra Australis. Field has been collecting a history of English satire. In fact, it's Tory, basically Anglican satire, I suppose, and it's embedded in this in all of these poems in a number of ways. Now, one of the things that is really important for me to ask, if I can even find my page number, is why, I've already said, Australia is quite a new word in the context. Why would you call it first fruits? Because Field is so clear, this is the first book of poems published in Australia, no one's ever bothered to question, well, of course it's first fruits, it's Baron Field, with the paradox of his name, giving us first fruits. It's obviously just the first book of poetry published in this country. Of course, the etymology of satire itself, the word satire, very, very, a lot of dissent, but... I have to say that Swift's A Tale is stuffed with fruit jokes, not least because, as the OED puts it, classical Latin satura is probably a specific application of satura medley. According to the grammarian, satura is short for lanx satura, literally full dish, lanx dish plus satura, feminine of satur, full, see saturate, which is alleged to have been used for a dish containing various kinds of fruit. So it's literally a mixed bag. So the formal medley that is satire, its mixed fruits status, should underline the fact that satire typically emerges in zones of poetic aporia where both inherited and new formal modes have become untenable and, yes, exhaust the field, no new third way is available. That is, where it's currently impossible to invent a new poetics, a medley of the old and an outrageous formal deformation of the forms becomes available, inducing writers such as Field to the self-annihilating, self-reflexive assemblage that is satire in this case. However, and this, I'm going to go very fast, but I also want to say this. Stuart Banner has recently noted that Field may have been decisive in the development of the doctrine of terra nullius. That is, that the European colonists were settling unoccupied land. One of the abiding puzzles regarding the centrality of this extreme doctrine in Australia is how it came to be established at all. Now, the first such statement, Banner writes, express statement of terra nullius in Australia appears to have been made in 1819, 1819, when a dispute arose between Lachlan Macquarie, the Governor of New South Wales, and Baron Field, Judge of the New South Wales Supreme Court, over whether the Crown, acting through Macquarie, had the power to impose taxes on the residents of New South Wales, or whether that power was reserved to Parliament, as was the case with taxes imposed on residents of Britain. Field, in a possibly self-conscious replay of Sir Edward Cook's objections to the use of the kingly prerogative by James I in the early 16th century, that is, to the very disputes that ultimately debouched to Cromwell's victory in the English Revolution, came down on the side of Parliament. The matter was referred to Earl Bathurst, the Secretary to the Colonies back in Whitehall, who referred in turn the matter to Samuel Shepherd, Attorney General, and Robert Gifford, the Solicitor General, who agreed with Field. So, the first formal statement of terra nullius in Australia seems to derive from a tax dispute between the colonial governor of a penal colony and the self-assured judge who's Baron Field. Obviously, fruits as outcomes, as enjoyments, as taxes, above all refer in the history of European law to the primacy of an agricultural civilization. And indeed, Field, in his geographical memoirs, notes the ongoing displacement of Australian flora and fauna through the extension of agriculture in the colony, not to mention the distress of the original inhabitants. So, at precisely the same moment that Field is arguing about whether Governor Macquarie can tax him, he produces these poems as if to say, "Fuck you, Macquarie, here are all the taxes you're getting from me." The name Australia in Field's poetry doesn't designate a stable tax entity, but rather functions as literally a science fictional name drawn from the history of satire. One of the things that this book and its poems do is to establish what was once a satire of imaginary spaces as realistic, futuristic projection. Field's citation's not illustrative nor argumentative, but kind of deranging and exhibitive. They draw attention to particular intertexts, Swift, Hall, etc., to their matter, Terra Australis, to their genre, satire, to their address, to the gap or incapacity vis-a-vis their own site. And finally, first fruits, poetry is the false money with which refused taxes are paid for in a colonial site. I'm going to stop there because I could go on a long time, but I hope the message is clear. The first fruits of these titles is saying I'm not going to pay tax to Governor Macquarie. Thank you.